so I pulled it off.
Right, yep.
But having been around baseball, if you're around baseball, just like if you work as a grip, you've been on more sets than most people, so you understand how they work.
Sure, yeah.
But I certainly have done episodics on TV, a lot of commercials over the years, so I have definitely been a professional scout. I mean, a professional actor.
Right, right.
And I've been a member of the Screen Actors Guild since 1975, so I would say that qualifies me for being an actor.
I would say so. I would call my research insufficient prior to speaking to you. Bennett said that he first met you, at least professionally, during a commercial that he was doing. Is that
part, yes, it was right? An AT&T commercial. It was about a year before Moneyball, and I went on the initial interview, and in the process, you have callbacks where they kind of narrow it down.
Yeah.
And I was kind of taken back because you come back on the callback, and the first thing he says, what do you think about Billy Bean and Moneyball?
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking, well, that's an interesting question. But I had my own feeling about the whole Moneyball thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we shot an AT&T commercial, and then a year later, of course, when I went in with several scouts that I put together for a meeting with Bennett.
Mm-hmm.
That's when they asked me to come in and read with Francine, the casting director, and then he asked me if I would feel intimidated reading for Brad with Brad Pitt.
Right.
And I said, I don't know. What's he hitting? And Bennett actually called me and said, we've been trying to cast this part for Grady. It's a very instrumental part in the movie because he's kind of the opposing view of what's going on with the whole cybernetics of baseball.
Right.
And he said, and you have the part.
Oh, great.
But I have actually been involved in some big movies with some big actors. Brewster's Millions, I worked with Richard Pryor and John Candy. Another 48 Hours, and you know, on and on and on. There's been a lot of movies that I was involved in.
Do you feel that in your, many think that you've acted in before, did you feel that you nailed it any as well as you did here in Moneyball?
Well, the thing with Moneyball is I got the opportunity to actually get a part that had, it was more of an extensive part.
Yeah.
I worked on several Walter Hill movies, but like The Last Man Standing, I had a lot more time on the movie. I was on it for almost 2.5 months.
Uh-huh. Right.
For in this one, our scenes at the scouting room and all that was done at Sony in a relatively short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
Which, as an actor, you want to be on a movie as long as you can, obviously, because that extends your role sometimes, and sometimes it just extends your pay.
Yep. So they shot all those locker room scenes on a soundstage at Sony?
Yeah, they built all those sets at Sony, so you walk in there, and here's an Oakland clubhouse that looked like, you know, a Major League clubhouse, and then they had the scouting room.
Right.
Where, as a player, I was, you know, you'd go to spring training, and my first two teams were the Dodgers and the Giants, and they were just both loaded with talent.
Mm-hmm.
And as a player, you kind of look around you and you think, well, you know, this guy can play, and the players have a pretty good grip on it, and then 3 weeks into it, somebody will get released, and it throws everybody into a tailspin to say, if this guy can get released, none of us are safe.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, that kind of thing. So I saw a lot of the results of those meetings, but I have never been in on one of those meetings.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So in Moneyball, I got a chance not only to be in on the meeting, but be the head of scouting who pretty much runs the meeting along with the general manager played by Brad.
Yeah. Now, the interesting thing, what Bennett told me, is that you actually are pretty much of a non-fan of the whole of Billy Bean's approach to being a GM and the whole Moneyball thing. So you're basically, you are that guy that we meet in the film. Is that true?
Well, pretty close. I thought that there was, it's funny because several criticisms have come out since the movie, and the one that a lot of baseball people have said is they never mentioned the fact that they had those three pitchers.
And, I've heard that too,
actually. In the second scene, the scouting scene, I actually started out with we're going to trade a gorilla for a rabbit, speed for power. Mm-hmm. And if we can go first to third and manufacture some runs with our pitching, we're going to stay close in a lot of games.
Right.
And I did mention our pitching, and that just didn't happen to end up, you know, in the movie.
Yeah.
But we did cover that. And I've always, you know, I mean, I look back as a kid growing up with the Dodgers and remember Koufax and Drysdale and all that, and they were winners until Koufax retired after the 66 season, and then they went into a fourth-place team.
Mm-hmm.
So I know how important pitching is, and the better you're pitching, the less offense you have to have. There's historically been a lot of great teams, a lot of the Pirate teams that were just full of great hitters that still didn't get there because they didn't have the first line of defense, which is pitching.
Yeah, of course.
And knowing, having been a manager and coach and a player, you realize that numbers can be very deceiving. There are people on a ball club that may not have great numbers, but they're very valuable to a ball club or to a manager.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of what they can do that doesn't show up in numbers. And there are also guys that put up great numbers that are really not that impressive.
Yeah.
Guys that get their hits with usually nobody on or two outs when it doesn't mean much, or the 250 hitter that gets his 1-for-4 when it really matters. Clutch hitting. And so there's always, you know, I was telling Bennett, I said, this isn't something new with baseball. Baseball has always been about numbers. You can pick up a box score from a game 75 years ago and look at the box score and pretty much figure out who did what. And baseball has always been conscious of records and how many hits and how many consecutive games, and you don't see that in any other sport. But everyone's always talked about the numbers in baseball. And so I think that with the computer, we're certainly accessible to a lot more information, but I think it still takes people that have been in the game. You know, otherwise, you could go out to a racetrack, and it's the guy that gets there at 5 o'clock in the morning and watches the horse work out, probably knows a lot more than the guy that sits up in the, you know, stands and reads the racing form and goes by that. So
yeah.
there's a good example of someone that takes into account all the horse's history and the guy that actually sees them working out at 5 o'clock in the morning.
It's also been pretty commonly, the movie says it, and it's said in the sports press that the industry, the baseball industry as a whole, it's pretty much co-opted or adopted the ideas that Billy was pushing that we see in the film, and that everybody started to think like that a bit more after that season and since. Is that something that you would concur with?
Well, I think the baseball has always been somewhat of... I remember when I first signed with the Dodgers, it was a very traditional game where change is very slow. For instance, it was gray uniforms on the road, white at home, and then the Oakland A's win three consecutive world championships from 72 to 74, 72, 3, and 4, and all of a sudden people started wearing the blue, the colored tops, the white shoes, the mix and match.
Uh-huh.
So it seems like whenever a team has a modicum of success, that a lot of teams follow up on that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought it was interesting in the movie when it said that Boston, 2 years after Billy turned down the job, they won the world championship and adapted his theory in Moneyball, but it's pretty hard to do that when you got the second highest payroll in baseball. So that seemed somewhat inconsistent. You know, Billy Beane in Oakland had a very small payroll, and, you know, there are teams that survive. The Minnesota Twins, for instance, they would lose Santana and you'd think they'd go in the tank, but yet they come back and compete. They'd lose Torrey Hunter. So someone in Minnesota is doing a great job with scouting and player development, and I've always thought that was the backbone of the game, because when you start projecting, you know, signing a kid out of high school or college and look at their numbers, you got to say, well, you know, it's kind of like a prize fighter. They've got an undefeated record, but they haven't fought anybody. So when you realize there's bigger giants in the valley, and that's what scouts have to do to find talent and player development, and then you got a lot of people that can play the game, and there's guys that put up great numbers in the minor leagues and don't do it. Like, for instance, the Dodgers had a lot of players at Albuquerque, which was a real hitting-friendly ballpark, and you saw the numbers they would put up at Albuquerque, and then they'd come to Los Angeles and wouldn't put up those numbers. Well, a lot of it had to do with the ballpark they played in, the weather. There's a lot of factors where teams maybe in the East didn't have the advantage of having a ballpark that was hitting-friendly, had a big ballpark, so those numbers would be reflected in a negative way, but that doesn't mean that player is any less effective.
I think everybody who's, that I've spoken to, and that certainly includes myself, is very much in love with the metaphor, the idea of Moneyball, which is that you can. There are guys out there that are guys with great potential. They have potential for glory and transcendence in their abilities, and things can happen. Really good things can happen, and you don't have to pay the top dollar Yankee level salaries for that to happen. And it's a matter of finding that specialness in people. The Yankee approach, New York Yankee approach to baseball is, you know, is basically the way the country works. The country has a top layer, and there's a whole thing going on right now with Occupy Wall Street. You know, we are the 99%, the 1% are the ones that have the great life, and we're all struggling. There's kind of a analogy going on there, and I think that's part of why people like this film, because it echoes, I think, into other levels of our life.
Well, I think you can certainly take some credence to that. The Yankees seem to be the evil empire, and everybody thinks that they're making, you know, all these deals and bringing these players in that have huge contracts. The right. Red Sox are always, you know, you can always look at the cities, Los Angeles, Chicago, New York. Those are big markets, and it's like anything else. When you have an abundance of something, there's a lot more waste going on than someone that if you're on a fixed income, you right. are a lot smarter about how you spend your money out of necessity. And if you're very affluent, then there's waste, and there are things that people buy, toys that they buy that they could really do without, and they end up in a shelf somewhere or in a garage, where people that don't have that money are spending their money a lot more wisely.
Yep.
And I think that certainly holds true in ball clubs and baseball, but there's a lot of people out there that can play.
Yeah, yeah. Is there a... I think what is really great about what I loved about your performance is there's just authority. I believed you instantly. I'm sure that's because of your background, but you also have a great voice. It sounds like you are a guy who holds his ground. You don't sound wishy-washy. You sound like a straight shooter. And I guess
I took the character, and I actually called several people and asked them if they knew who Grady Poussant was.
Right.
And I do my homework. Whenever I have a role, I take on, and I really do research that character, because I think that's essential to develop that character and take that into a situation like that. And right. this was a subject matter that I certainly understood. To me, I got to take my hat off to Brad, who really doesn't have a real baseball background, and he really came across very well as a general manager.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, but I have never been in on one of those scouting meetings.
Really?
I've seen the result of them, but yeah, I did my homework and developed that character, and since I was the head of scouting, I knew that I was the one that pretty much ran the meeting along with the general manager.
Yeah.
So I did take on that character of authority, and I was very steadfast to being a traditionalist, and understanding that you can have all the numbers in the world, but it still comes down to good scouts that can find talent
right.
and player development that can develop that talent.
Mm-hmm. What are you doing?
It's a very fine line. I was talking to some kids I was working with. I said, you got to understand the fine line of baseball. If you go 2 for 5, do you think he had a good game? And the kid, okay. You know, I said, well, if you go 2 for 5. And every 5 at bats from the time you're in high school, you'll have a wing in Cooperstown with your name on it. Go 1 for 5, you're probably not going to play past high school. So how's that for a fine line?
that's good advice.
2 for 5, you're the best ever, and 1 for 5, you're a welder.
Yeah, right. So have you gotten? This is probably, I would imagine, put you back in, or put you higher, I guess would be the way to put it, in a kind of a, you know, for people who want that quality, that vibe, that authority that you bring. But I really liked your performance. I just think that I think you're a good actor, you know. So,
well, thank you. I appreciate that. And, you know, obviously I'm very proud to be part of this movie.
Yeah.
And when you work in a segment, it's like you get four or five pieces of the puzzle and you really don't know what the big picture is going to be. But when I saw the movie I had several people tell me when I first got cast in the movie, they said, you know, I really don't see how this movie that was based on a book is going to really be able, you're going to make a movie out of it, maybe a documentary, but I don't see how you can make a movie. So right. Credit to Aaron, who wrote it, and Brad, who did a great job. The Bennett, of course, was just absolutely incredible the way he allowed actors the freedom and wanted to get the authenticity. And a director is kind of like a manager of a baseball team. And right. When you have a manager that you know believes in you, you don't go up there and have that feeling that if I don't produce, I'm going to be out of the lineup.
No,
Bennett gave you that kind of confidence. Wally, our camera operator, he was incredible. And the whole set was really conducive to getting it right. And I really thought they did a great job getting it right. The baseball was very good, very believable. And I think that incorporating the actual footage from those playoff games and the baseball that they did have looked very believable, and having been in that world, I thought, wow, this really came across very well.
Have you seen it only at a industry screening with invited, or have you been to see it with regular folks, or how many times have you seen it?
I've done it both ways. I went to Toronto to the film festival. That's the first time I saw it.
I saw it up
and
there, too.
And then I came back, and we had a cast and crew screening over at Sony.
Uh-huh.
And then we had the screening up in Oakland.
Oh, when was that? Was that with the team and everything?
That was on the 19th, and I think the Oakland team was there. And I actually, when I came out and Bennett introduced everybody on stage at the Paramount Theater there in Oakland,
right.
Ron Washington, who's been a friend of mine for a long time, he was actually sitting there. I guess Texas was playing Oakland, and they had an off night, so Ron Washington was there, and when I walked out, he ran over and grabbed me, and, you know, hey, Kenny, how you doing, and blah, 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 and I text him quite a bit during the playoffs and everything. When Texas lost their first game, 9-0, I texted him and said the Los Angeles Dodgers lost to the White Sox in 1959, 11-0 in the first game, and the Dodgers won the series in 6 games, so you got them right where you want them, Wash.
You know what I would, on top of many other things, I mean, I said I'd love to see you be an actor in other parts henceforth, but you would be great doing commentary, just with that great voice of yours and all your knowledge. You would be great to listen to, you know, as one of the team's moderators. Have you ever had that gig thrown at you?
I've never had that thrown at me, but Kevin Kennedy is a real good friend of mine, and Kevin's been doing it for a long time, and I would love to do something like that, because I do have a lot of knowledge in baseball, because it's been a passion since I was, you know, 9 years old.
Yeah.
It's funny, my next-door neighbor came over and knocked on my door and said he had tickets to the Dodgers, and they had, you know, they were still playing at the L.A. Coliseum.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't know what the Dodgers were, and he asked if I wanted to go, and I said, yeah, sure, you know, and I went with him, and I never will forget my first impression of walking through that tunnel at the Coliseum and seeing this huge, massive stadium that I've never seen before, anything like that, and the grass, and the Cincinnati Reds were playing the Dodgers, and the balls flying all over, and it was just something I had never seen before. It was amazing, and Roger Craig pitched for the Dodgers against Jim Maloney. And ironically, Roger Craig signed me. I was the first player he ever signed as a scout.
Wow.
And the first player signed with the Dodgers in 67. And it was kind of funny how he pitched in the first game I ever saw and ended up signing me. I was the first player he signed. So that kind of lit a fire. And from that point on, I fell in love with the game. And that passion's always been there. And I still have an interest in baseball. And
right.
I've actually gone out and managed and coached in professional baseball during the summer months,
right.
when it usually slows down in the movie business.
Hmm.
But, yeah, I would love to do color or something like that, because I do have a good knowledge of the game.
So the it's funny, that would be an odd place to see baseball. How many years were the Dodgers at the Coliseum? They were waiting for Chavez Ravine to be built, and they were out there just temporarily. I didn't know. I'd forgotten about that.
Yeah, when they moved out here in 1958 was their first year in Los Angeles. The Coliseum was the only ballpark around. Of course, the Angels played at Wrigley over there in L.A. somewhere. They had that park for the Angels first play, but the Dodgers went to the Coliseum,
right,
and they played there from 1958 until the opening of Dodger Stadium in 1962.
Wow, I didn't know that. 4 years.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it was really fun because obviously you have a football stadium, and they had to build a big Chinese, what they call the Chinese screen, in left field, so some of the best balls would hit off that screen, and you could, you know, Wally Moon would hit what they called moon shots, where he would inside out the ball as a left-handed hitter and hit little lazy fly balls that were outs.
Right.
In other ballparks, it would go over that short fence that was only 250 feet down the line.
You know, when
so it created sort of a fun house to play baseball, but boy, Los Angeles fell in love with the Dodgers, and I think probably the person most responsible for their success was Vin Scully, who was, I remember going to sleep as a kid listening to Dodger games and Vin Scully, and so it was really a thrill for me when they signed me, and they took me to the ballpark, and I set up in the press box with Vin Scully and Jerry Doggett interviewing me during a Houston Astro game when I first signed, so that was thrilling. But, yeah, they played in the Coliseum from 1958, then they came in eighth place the first year here, and then the next year in 59, of course, they won the pennant and World Series.
One thing I've always said to people is that what matters to me almost as much, well, almost the same as who's playing and how much feeling and how much passion I have for the team that, you know, if I'm somebody I like or don't like. I feel it's really important to sit near the third or first baselines and to be close enough to smell the earth and smell the grass. If I can do that, I feel it is something, it's hard to describe, but it's almost like a mystical sense of peace that comes over me if I'm close enough to smell the aroma of that grass.
Well, you know something, I share that sensory response myself because I walked into Big Five yesterday to try to find some pine tar for a friend of mine's kid, and I said, I remember my first year spending the night at Tommy Lasorda's house and getting to his car and driving up to Ogden, Utah, which was the Dodgers rookie league club, and walking in the clubhouse, and the first thing I smelled was that smell of pine tar, and there are smells that I will immediately flash right to a baseball park, fresh mowed grass and all that, those smells that are associated with the game.
Yeah.
Even I remember smelling a baseball or my first glove, and it was just a smell that I will always, you know, you could blindfold me and put that up, and I go, oh, that's a baseball, that's a glove.
That, yeah, exactly.
You know, the smell of a foul ball when you kind of smell wood burning when you foul it off, and
I got my two gloves.
You're very distinguishing, yeah.
I've got mink oil that I put on my glove every now and then. I love the smell of that also. So it's
the same type of thing. I mean, anybody, that's one thing wonderful about baseball. So many of us were introduced to it at an early age, and
yeah,
all the smells that are associated with the game, and especially the pine tar. I mean,
yeah,
just every clubhouse you walk in, and
right,
you can smell that pine tar, and it's just part of the whole atmosphere.
How much... How much time did you and Brad need to get that great scene where you get pissed off and he finally cans you at the end? How many times do you have to do that scene? Was it easy? Is it hard? How long did that work?
Well, you know, it was so good working with Brad because I respect him very much as an actor and even more so as a person, getting to know him and all the things that he does outside of acting, which I think is, I really admire him for that.
Right.
But once again, Bennett Miller, who created the atmosphere, the camera operator, all these people that were, you know, that made the environment real good. And we, spent actually 14 hours on that scene. The first day, it was over Brad on me.
Uh-huh.
And then the second day, it was over Brad. Over me on Brad. And
right.
So it was really nice. The second day we walked in,
mm-hmm.
and Brad walked up to me first thing in the morning and put his arms around me and whispered in my ear, and he said, "It doesn't get any harder than what they had you doing yesterday, and you nailed it." And that was really very assuring. It was really a nice confidence builder.
Yeah.
Because you get into it, and it's almost a surreal thing where you're doing all this. And I remember the first day that Bennett walked up, and his whole motivation is to get the scene right that he has in his head.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't feel like he treated me any different than Philip Seymour Hoffman or Brad Pitt or Jonah or anybody. His deal was, these are my characters, and this is what I want.
Mm-hmm.
And he walked up and he said, "You know, I think that Brad might be losing a little energy. We had been into that room for 12 hours. And he said, this time, when he says, 'I'm not going to fire you,' and you tell him what you tell him."
Yep.
"And walk away, I want you to walk up to him and put your left hand on his shoulder like you're going to finish it with a right cross."
That was good. You guys came to blows. That was good. I like that.
Well, that's the scene that they actually used in that. And when I did that and he reacted, it was something he absolutely didn't know I was going to do. And Bennett got his reaction shot.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I exited, Philip Seymour Hoffman was in the training room kind of on looking.
Yep.
And when I walked out of there, I just looked at him and said, "Good luck, Art." And that wasn't really written in the movie. It was just, I told Bennett, I said, this is the manager. I'm head of scouting. We know each other. We're on the same page. We're traditional baseball people."
Right.
"And this guy's bringing in Ray Charles to go duck hunting." And so naturally, I would say something to him because he was one of my, you know, allies.
Sure.
You know, and they ended up covering it, and they ended up using it in the movie. So
it was perfect. That's exactly.
Absolutely, I give the credit to Bennett and Brad. That
right.
It was very easy to play off of those guys and do what we did. And it was like 14 hours each day.
Wow,
long days.
Well, long days, hard work, but. That's how you get the good material, because it's
and a lot
really
of stuff.
Well.
I mean, Brad said they're walking up and giving you monologues and say, "Let's do this. Camera's rolling. Wait, wait, wait. Can I read it?"
You know?
And, and so they took a lot of the writer's ideas, and when I saw the movie, I noticed how there were things that were out of context in terms of how we shot them and the order we shot them, but.
Yeah.
Reversing back and forth, you know, there was a lot of stuff that was put in there, and to me it was funny because at the time I didn't really remember what was said. I was just kind of moment to moment, and when I saw it, I was pleased with the reaction, and I thought that they
mm-hmm.
pretty much got what they wanted in terms of me being an antagonist and standing up to him. And
right.
A couple of people said that scene actually clarified the conflict between what he was doing and what the traditional person. I mean, it was like my attitude. One of the scouts asked me, and I said, "Well, this is the problem here. We run a buggy whip factory, and this guy's coming in here with a gasoline engine formula."
Yeah, yeah.
So it's really challenging our existence and what we do, and scouting is not an exact science, and neither is numbers.
Right.
It's kind of like managing. There's two moves you can make. You can do the percentage move, and you can do the hunch move, and there's no guarantee that either one of them is going to work.
One thing that one of the first things I said to Bennett after I saw it for the first time, I said that, you know, despite the interesting thing about this film is despite the emphasis on stats and numbers and Jonah Hill's input into this whole scenario. What I loved about it was that I felt there was moments when the baseball gods just kind of decided to blow favoring winds in the direction of the Angels. It's just like the gods or the angels, whatever you want to call them, but the, you know, fate was suddenly working on behalf of that team, and it was kind of.
We used to call them the baseball gods.
Yeah,
you know, and there are, you know, no two games. Kind of like a rodeo. No two horses buck the same, but a rodeo is a rodeo, right?
Right.
And a baseball game is very much like that. You can go to games for 20 years, and you'll never see any game that's the exact same.
Yeah.
And there are times when a team will get hot and win, and you'll say, how did this team actually achieve what they did? And a lot of it has to do with team chemistry, guys getting along good. You'll see guys having career years that mm-hmm. Collectively that all of a sudden the team just has momentum going, and no one can explain it other than the baseball gods.
What is your, apart from Moneyball, what is your favorite baseball movie, you know, before you made Moneyball? What's your favorite, just as a moviegoer?
Well, I think the Pride of the Yankees is one. It was a love story set in a baseball background. So yeah. This Moneyball was kind of similar to that in a way. This was a movie about the cybernetics of baseball set in a baseball background, obviously. But I love The Natural. I loved Field of Dreams, and those two were kind of in a different category. Bull Durham.
Yeah.
I remember seeing that, and the first time I saw it, I said, this is 2 hours of cliches that I heard over a 10-year period playing. And it was all jammed into a movie, so it was kind of like hearing a lot of jokes and stories that I had heard before. And Ron Shelton being a former player, and it was ironic because my second year with the Dodgers, I was in the Florida State League in Daytona Beach, and we shared the locker room there with the Rochester Red Wings, and Ron Shelton was on that team. So we were two ships passing in the night. We'd go on the road, and they'd come in and use the ballpark. So half of our clubhouse belonged to the Rochester Red Wings, and the other half was the Daytona Beach Dodgers. So that was kind of ironic, and I got a chance to work with Ron Shelton on a after-school special, little thing about the girl that broke her leg in softball. And we talked about, you know, being in the same place at different times in our lives, you know, so it was kind of funny.
I noticed, I just happened to notice that you were in the remake of Bad News Bears.
Yes.
The 2000, which I didn't even see that one, but I love the old one
That was the thing where my agent called and said they need an umpire to do this thing, and they got a little scene with Billy Bob Thornton, and I, you know, it was like a one day gig, so I went out there and was the umpire and had dialogue with him, and it was not a very big part, but I just wanted to work in it to get a chance to work with Billy Bob, and I went out and did that. So the scene in Moneyball is really the best chance I've ever had as an actor to actually take a character that is significant and have a significant role in it.
Yep, I completely agree. And I think
it's kind of like playing in the minor leagues, and then someone says, okay, someone got hurt, we're going to call you up to the big leagues, and you know, I'm all of a sudden like Lou Johnson when Tommy Davis breaks his ankle and no one's ever heard of Lou Johnson. He comes up and gets a chance to play and produces and leads the Dodgers to a pennant that year.
Yeah. No, it's the best performance by a guy I didn't know that well all year. I mean, it's one of the ones I'll keep in my head and my heart because it's one of my probably my favorite film of the year. And yours is a really superb performance, and I got to congratulate you again.
I really appreciate those nice words, and it's nice that when people see your work and it's acknowledged, and a professional like yourself, that means a lot.
Thank you, man. We'll be talking, and I'll try and put this up like tomorrow or something, but thanks very much for taking the time, and thank you for that excellent photo you sent me.
Oh, anytime. You like that? Is that what you wanted?
Exactly. Perfect.
Great.
Okay, man.
Well, it was nice talking to you. I hope we meet someday.
Yeah, me too. Take care.
Okay, buddy.
Bye.
Bye.